On Wednesday, Anna DeVlantis joins us for This Week in Chicago History. Anna, good morning.
Morning, Bob.
Let's talk about, you hear a lot about fake news. This was a fake bar, wasn't it?
Fake bar and a legendary moment in Chicago journalism, Bob. I'm sure you'll remember this. It's just, we study it in journalism books ever since. It's the time journalists in Chicago bought a bar as part of an undercover sting operation to capture city workers, you know, asking for bribes and also accepting them. It was a bar that they opened at 731 North Wells called The Mirage, a fitting name if you think about it. Mm-hmm. And it was bought by the Chicago Sun-Times and the Better Government Association with this whole idea that Pam Zekman, legendary investigative journalist who was at CBS2 for many, many years, she said that she was getting so many tips from small business owners saying, I got to pay off the city inspectors in order to pass code. My bar, I can't bring it up to code. I can't pass inspections. I have to keep handing envelopes over. But none of them would go on camera. So she said, here's an idea. Let's set up a bar. Let's buy the diviest bar possible, one with, that doesn't meet inspection, that won't meet, isn't up to code, and let's see how they treat us. Mm-hmm. And so they positioned this camera above the bar, and it is a pinhole camera that was capturing all these envelopes going across the bar from city worker after city worker. The journalists themselves were serving up the drinks. They were working the bar. Pam was at the bar. She said she didn't know how to make drinks, but she certainly had to do a good investigative journalism report because they captured so many people. Here is, we have an excerpt from Chris Fusco, the former Sun-Times editor-in-chief, describing this moment in time.
Sun-Times scouted dozens of locations for this tavern, and they found one that was just kind of outside the Rush Street corridor in River North. Even in an era where newspapers did a lot of undercover journalism, heavy lifting, reporters being able to take months to do work on one story, this one stood out because of its creativity and the overall characters that the story brought out. This story exposed things in ways that Chicagoans, as they were actually reading the story in the Sun-Times, were chuckling at the schemes uncovered. Shakedowns, bribery, tax gyps, from the lawyer that worked with them to set up the bar, to the building inspectors coming in, to the fire inspector with the cigarette dangling out of his mouth as he's talking to them about their fire inspection.
They had all this great video, but it was for a newspaper series. This week in 1977, the Sun-Times started a 25-part series in the paper on that.
Totally. And it just, you think about, you're right, it was kind of wasted because the video would have been priceless. But the pictures were enough to put away a lot of people, many, many indictments, Bob, lots of corrupt activity exposed. And they were ultimately nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, but it led to so many conversations about whether this was the right way to do journalism. So the Pulitzer Prize Committee actually said, we're not going to give it to you Sun-Times because we don't want to endorse this kind of journalism. Pam Zekman always said that this was the only way to do it, and that's why they chose to do it, because no one would go on camera for fear of losing their business or being, you know, facing some sort of reciprocity.
They should have won the Pulitzer. I mean, and Pam Zekman's idea was fantastic.
Absolutely.
Well, it's a Connor Bedard fever these days around here, but this week in 2007, it was another kid hockey player we were all
young
crazy
kid,
about,
young,
huh?
A young newly drafted Blackhawk named Patrick Kane came to town in 2007, and he scored his very first career goal in the NHL this week. It was the beginning of a thrilling era for him, for the Blackhawks, for all of us as fans, barely 2 weeks into his professional debut, Bob, and drafted by the Hawks first overall, I should say. High hopes on him, for sure. He did not disappoint, not out of the gate, not at all, ever, and here's what that thrilling moment at the United Center, October 19th, 2007.
Leopold over the Hawk line, stripped of the puck by Patrick Sharp. He and Patrick Kane have a 2-on-1 break. Kane in over the line, moves it, she scores!
This play, just kind of a turnover. Sharpie got the puck and made a nice pass under the guy's stick and just tried to get it and shoot it real quick. But yeah, this being my first goal, Sharpie always reminds me that that he gave me the pass on a few of my goals. But fun to see him go and pick up the puck, and fun to see he was on the ice too. There was Newski and Donks and Taser.
His first goal in the National Hockey League! Patrick Kane, set up by Patrick Sharp!
Did you ever really think you were going to go back to junior?
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't have a great preseason. Some of the guys say it was funny kind of when the regular season started. I just kind of flipped the switch and started turning it on. I played really good my first game in Minnesota, even though I didn't have any points, and just started getting better and better. And around this time, my seventh, eighth, or ninth game, they told me I could, I'd be sticking with the team that season.
He might be coming back this year, I guess. He had hip surgery, and been out, right, Dave?
Right. He's hip resurfacing surgery. He's still recovering, but he's a free agent.
It was a pretty big deal back then in 2007, wasn't it, Anna?
You know, it's interesting. Think about how many just magical moments he created for us as Hawks fans, and how many just wow. I mean, just how he wowed us. 2.5 short years later, actually, after that first goal, just 2.5 years later, Kane would score the incredible game-winning goal in overtime to bring the Stanley Cup home to Chicago for the first time in 49 years. Mm-hmm. Such a thrilling time. And two more cups after that. So just incredible memories for all of us as Hawks fans, and just cool to think back to that young player who started it all for us.
Kane and Taves. And William the Refrigerator Perry made a name for himself this week in 1985, didn't he?
Another first for a major Chicago sports figure this week, Bob. This week, rookie defensive lineman William Refrigerator Perry scored his first touchdown in his first season with the Bears as a rookie. Coach Ditka personally picked out Perry in the draft, pushing the team to draft him in the first round. Really believed in this young player, and would often play him as fullback in goal line situations, as we recall as Bears fans so many times, just punching through to the end zone. Here's the call from October 1985, the Fridge, and his first NFL touchdown.
First down, goal to go. Perry is in the offensive backfield for the Bears. He'll be the lead blocker. They get him the football, and Perry, touchdown. William Perry spikes the football, and this crowd loves it. Perry may revolutionize short yardage offense. There was Red Grange, there was Willie Gallimore, there was Gale Sayers, and now there's William Perry. A moment ago, 350 pounds banging into the end zone, and he had the audacity to put it in the air, OJ.
To dive in. Give me a break, William.
That's pretty good.
Nobody wanted much to do with William Perry, however.
Yeah, it's Frank Gifford on the call there.
With OJ.
And OJ Simpson. Yeah, you're right, Dave.
Wow.
And let's see. He, of course, that touchdown he scored in the Super Bowl, a lot of people were upset with that, right? Because they thought Peyton should have gotten the
Dave
ball.
Dave can go into that. You think about it. You know, he still holds the record for the heaviest player ever to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl. But, of course, very controversial touchdown, Dave. A lot of people wanted that to be Walter Payton's hands.
Wanted it to be Walter Payton. And, of course, you know, the thing about Perry, too, if you remember, after that Monday night game against Green Bay, when they went back up to Green Bay 2 weeks later, they threw to Perry in the end zone for a touchdown. Jim McMahon hit him with a touchdown pass. So,
yeah.
I mean, it became an absolute phenomenon. It was crazy.
It really was wild.
He's a boogie 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 company bee.
Well, Chicago music history now at 8:51 with Anna DeVlantis. Tell us about this, Anna.
Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy traces back to one of the most iconic songs from the big band era, Bob. The Andrews Sisters released it this week, 1941, and it climbed to the top of the charts, a doo-wop hit for sure that survived the generations. You hear it in so many movies over the years that kind of try to capture that period of time. It's a song about a Chicago trumpeter who was renowned, a great musician, highly regarded, respected musician, who got drafted into the army and then resorted to have to play wake up call for the troops, you know, the morning wake up call on his trumpet. And just, you know, a lot of people thought that was below him, but not to worry. The Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy was able to just craft such amazing wake up calls and musical arrangements that he just drew the respect and really, you know, kind of just pumped up the troops at that time. So he became famous, really. Mm-hmm. And they wrote the song about him. Never really identified him. A lot of people thought it was this person or that person, but it certainly was based on a true story. And the Andrews Sisters went on to be nominated for an Oscar, and also that song inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. So Pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
Yes, played this week in 1941, first by disc jockey John Landecker.
Ooh.
And Bette Midler.
Was he around then?
Bette Midler had the hit in more recent times. This is a bit of cell phone history, isn't it? Chicago played a big part in developing these phones.
Super cool. You think about it, how it changed the world, Bob, in every way, shape, and form. 1983, the very first commercial cell phone call was placed from Chicago. And actually right outside the Soldier Field in the parking lot, it was made by David Milhan, a local insurance rep who won a contest by Ameritech to place that very first call. Ameritech had developed this exciting new technology and just had gotten approval from the FCC to turn their experimental cellular network into a commercial one. And they wanted to do this big thing to promote it. So they invited 15 candidates who showed up to see who could install a chip, fire up a phone the fastest, and then run to their car and place the call. Well, that guy, David Milhan, won. And so he was the guy. So sitting in his Chrysler convertible on October 13th, 1983, he made the first commercial phone call. And fun fact, that phone call was transferred from his car to an overseas line placed to the granddaughter of Alexander Graham Bell.
Wow.
Pretty awesome, you think about it. Funny thing is, though, she only spoke German, so he said it was a really quick call. It was just like niceties exchanged. But they did it nonetheless. And fair to say, the world changed that day, Bob. Just a really cool part of the cell phone history based right here in Chicago.
Do we know what he said? It was probably, "Guess where I am," right? Remember when we all used to say that? Guess
yeah,
where
right.
I'm calling you from.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now? And I love this item about chicken pot pie. I could go for one right now. It's that kind of a day.
They're the best. Fall, winter time. Who doesn't want a nice, yummy chicken pot pie? They're kind of hard to make, too, if you've ever tried them. I don't know if Marianne does the chicken pot pie, but the crust.
I'll have to ask her to do that.
Challenging. Very challenging. But this week, 1890, the best chicken pot pie ever introduced. So good, it would launch the Marshall Field's Walnut Room. Miss Sarah Herring was this enterprising young store clerk at Field's in the hat department. And she recognized that if you just serve up a little lunch to the ladies while they shop, they'd stay longer and they'd buy more hats. So she served up her chicken pot pie and they thought it was so delicious. They kept bringing friends back over and over and they'd spend a lot more time in the store. They bought a lot of hats, and you know, fast forward, one of the top executives at Fields noticed this, and he said, "Hey, this is a great idea. Let's start offering some kind of a lunch service or tea service to the ladies while they shopped and keep them in the store." So Fields opened a tea room, which expanded to seat 1,500 people in time for the Columbian Exposition, so they could have a lot of people packed in there for tea, and that eventually turned into the Walnut Room.
Mm-hmm.
So, pretty
cool.
And
that, they say it's the very same recipe that's still on the menu, don't they?
Still on the menu and still delicious. I haven't had it in a while, but we always make a trip up there around holiday time, and it's just, it's so good. So good to this day.
And it's not the $18.90 price of 45 cents anymore, but
I know. I think it was 40.
Well,
honestly, I think it was 45 cents back in the day. It's gone up a bit, Bob.
Yeah, it does. All right, Anna, we'll talk to you next Wednesday. Thank you.
Talk to you then. Bye, Bob.